Hey people, I gotta take a second to tell you about something we do around here called the THC Money Bomb. What I do is every 5 episodes, I total up the donations I've gotten in that period of time, and half keeps me and the show going. I take the other half and I gift that back to a random listener. So far we're hitting about 500 each round and I couldn't be happier about it. So consider throwing in 5 or 10 bucks. It's cheaper than a hand at the blackjack table with better odds than a scratch-off ticket. Plus, you know half supports a show you like, and at the very least, half will go to a like-minded person who could probably use a nice surprise in these troubled times. When you make a donation, I can see your email address, and that's how I pick the winner. But to keep things kosher, you can also get in the pool by sending your info on a postcard to me, Greg Carlwood, P.O. Box 635223, San Diego, California, 92163. I got no subscription fees here, no paid archives, no paid bonus shows, and I want to keep it that way, on principle. But I'm not a millionaire at the podcast on the side. This is it for me. And I'm the only one I know who's trying to help the people out as well.
That's my man!
So help me help you. If you want to play along, go to thehiresidechats.com/donate and get in the game. Dollars, bitcoins, it's all good to me. And that's what we call the THC Money Bomb. Boom.
In the 1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of fire. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
Here we go, Fireside Chatters, drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke. I'm Greg Carlwood from San Diego, and this is episode 95. We're all still here. We have not collapsed yet. That's great. Gotta celebrate the little things. The banker deaths are now up to 9. So who knows if we're looking at some kind of Winston the Wolf cleaner guy covering the tracks of some Wall Street crimes. I don't even know if they need to do that, though. You can flat out tell us about the crimes in Wall Street, and everybody just kind of says, oh, that sucks, and goes about their day. So do you really need to kill 9 people? Debatable. But I don't know what's happening. Anyway, we have some really great guests coming up in March, several from the suggestions on the THC Facebook page and the subreddit, Fireside Chats. Please post more suggestions or even interesting news for the higher education segments there. That's cool too. And like I mentioned, it is episode 95. That means one money bomb has ended and another begins. This time we got $810 in donations, biggest one yet. Thanks a ton. I gave half, $405, to a lucky listener named Chrissy, who was kind enough to spend a few minutes with me for the show. We're going to play that. But first, I also got to say thanks to the people at Vapor Genie. They opted to send me their new Volta vaporizer for free. I'm generally not a big fan of vaporizers. I can never tell if I'm inhaling enough because it's so subtle. I usually just end up putting the brown vaped weed in a bowl anyway, but I was sick last week. I might have celebrated my freedom a little too hard, and vaporizing weed is a lot less harsh. So it was convenient to have the Volta. It's a neat little battery-operated, really easy-to-use bamboo apparatus. And I should say that I am totally okay with a small company or a listener who's trying to get something off the ground, sending me a sample or something, and I'll mention them on the air. I can't do it all the time. I can't do it too much. And I don't want to go down the advertiser road. But that said, next time you're in the market for a piece, consider going to Vapor Genie just because they were bold enough and cool enough to support me and THC. And we're pretty out there. So I respect anyone who's willing to do that. And now let's get down to business, guys. This is a great one. I have been interested in the Bermuda Triangle for many years, and Gian is the go-to guy. He has several great stories about the Triangle, especially in the second half. So let's do this then. Thanks again to everyone. Here's just a few minutes with the new Money Bomb winner, because I'm sure the listeners are curious as to where their donations go. And on the other side, we're taking a trip through the Triangle with fascinating tales of mystery and a little amphibious Bigfoot for good measure with Gian Quasar. Hey, is this Chrissy?
Yeah, it is.
Hey, this is Greg from the Fireside Chats. How are you?
Hi, I'm actually super excited that I won. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. Congrats on winning. That's pretty awesome. Thanks for donating. You know, that's a big deal to donate $5 to some show you could listen to for free.
Well, cool. Thanks. And your show is really, really good.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Yeah, my husband and I both listen to you, and it's a really good show. We both love it. So,
do you have any favorite guests or topics that you like?
Oh, all of your topics, like all of your guests are really interesting, you know, and you know, your questions are always like just really insightful. You do really good interviews.
Ah, thank you.
And you know, sometimes even when your guests sound maybe a little, I don't know, like maybe you might not believe what they're saying, you still show them like a lot of respect and like seem really interested in whatever they're saying. And that's just really cool.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that.
Oh, my husband wanted me to mention that he loved Michael Rupert, the collapse guy that you had on the other week.
Yeah.
And he's like a big fan of Michael Rupert, I guess.
Well, that's very cool because a lot of people didn't seem to dig that one.
You know, I know a lot. Yeah, I heard you say that some people didn't really dig him, but, you know, my husband really did. So I thought it was good. I thought it was an interesting show. You know, I liked him. I liked Stephen Greer. You know, I know not everyone is.
Yeah, that's another one. That's another one of those guys.
Right. I thought he was really cool, though. I think he's really interesting.
That's awesome. Well, I wanted to say, you know, you got $405. It's not going to change your life, but it's a nice pile of money to walk into. And since it's kind of made up of the listeners' donations, the people might be curious if you have any idea how you would use it.
Oh, yeah, totally. Okay, super excited. Okay, so my husband is going to go, we're going to use $150. He's going to take it to get his GED. And then we've got one of our credit cards almost paid off, and actually the rest of it will just pay off one of our credit cards, so we'll get that out of the way. And
nice.
Then I think we're going to donate a little bit back into THC.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, because it's just a really good show, and, you know, I'm so excited that we won, and so I think just, you know, donate, I don't know, like $25-$50, something like that, back into the show for the next winner. And then also a friend of mine is doing the AIDS life cycle. It's like he's bicycling like 500 miles from like San Francisco down to LA to help raise money for AIDS and HIV. So we're going to donate some money to him.
That's so funny because, well, AIDS isn't funny, but my girlfriend has been talking about wanting to ride her bike from here in San Diego up to San Francisco for some kind of cause like that. There's one right there.
Oh, yeah, totally. Awesome.
Very cool. Well, hey, thanks, guys, for sticking with me on this little show of mine. I'm glad you like it enough to donate, and I'm glad you won. So thanks again.
Thank you.
All right. Well, take care of yourself.
Okay, you too.
All right, people. One of the most legendary mysteries on the planet is the strange enigma known as the Bermuda Triangle. Today's guest is one of the most respected authorities on the topic. He's the first person to have completely documented the Bermuda Triangle case by case in a thread of research spanning more than 12 years and over 350 cases that span over two centuries. His tenacity in finding every scrap available has gained him recognition as the man responsible for bringing the subject forward for an entirely new generation. His name is Gian Quasar, and I'm psyched to have him here. Gian, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Oh, can't complain, man. I'm really psyched for this. You've done some great research. And from what I understand, you sort of resurrected and expanded on the research of the Bermuda Triangle disappearances in a big way. Why don't you take a second to tell the people about that journey? Where was Bermuda Triangle research before you got started? How have you added to it?
That's been an old introduction of yours. It's been 25 years now.
I pulled it off of some website, but yeah, I thought it might be dated 25 years, long time.
Yeah, I think that's when my book came out. It was 12 years. Well, when I started in 1990, there was nothing. The Bermuda Triangle simply was gone. It had faded into the deep freeze, and the triangle for me had been something of mystery, of adventure, and I found it a very fascinating case. And in the 1970s, it was a big deal. for my generation when we were growing up.
Right.
And then it fell into the wayside by the late 70s. It was supposedly debunked and solved. And in the 1980s, it was simply in the deep freeze. No one talked about it anymore. And so I was curious about all that was said. If it was a real phenomenon, it would still be going on. And yet nothing, I could find nothing in 1990 that dated past 1977.
Hmm.
No disappearances, no discussions, nothing. So if it was true, it would still be going on. And I stumbled across the National Transportation Safety Board, and they did a database search for me. And they could go back to 1964. And so they searched for every missing aircraft. And lo and behold, there were probably 40 aircraft that had vanished during the 60s and 70s that the authors of the original and popular books didn't even know about because they had never consulted the archives. And then after that time, there were probably just as many, if not more, that had vanished in the late 70s and 1980s after no one bothered to inquire about the subject. And so I continued to get these updates. I continued to get reports. Accident reports existed as far back as 1978. And within these, there were, you know, one case where a pilot is panicking over a weird object harassing with his aircraft, in two cases in which aircraft vanished essentially with eyewitnesses watching them when while coming in for a landing. And that got me hooked. To me, I had found the great adventure, the great mystery that was full of hundreds of mysteries in an exotic location, and I continued to pursue it.
Yeah, man, it is a fascinating case. Do you have any idea why interest or research might have died off in the way it did? Was it considered solved in any way?
Well, there, you know, Charles Berlitz, who really popularized it, had a number of mistakes in his popular book. Larry Cush came along, a librarian from Arizona, and he took selective cases and could say that he solved some of these cases, and the book by Harper and Rowe built it up with the title Solved on it, and I suppose it just kind of died out after that.
Which makes sense.
It was so popular that it burned brightly and burned out quickly. And I have to tell you, it's an expensive mystery to research.
Really?
You have to travel the location. Just one incident, the USS Cyclops disappearance. I'm finishing up my book on that case alone. That cost me $500 just to get the official documentation. There are 2,000 pages in the archives. All these reports cost money. Very few are given free by the government agencies. You have to write, back in the days before internet, to get referred all over the place. You have to write international archives. And it's a time-consuming and expensive hobby. I was years researching this before I even tried to write a book. And all this was before the internet. I didn't get on the internet until 1999 with the website, and I had been researching since 1990. And it just really is quite engrossing because it is a very real a mystery. It's not a subjective one, as many of the other popular mysteries are.
Yeah, it's so unfortunate that they put such barriers of entry into just gaining information.
It's just the way archives work. Back then, before you could get anything online, you had to stumble around and write letters, and then they would refer you to another archive, and you had to ask, and they would tell you what they have. And it just takes years to put together everything. Today, it's much easier.
Yeah.
With the internet.
Now, at first, some people might think that it's not that mysterious that crafts have gone missing. I mean, the ocean is a big place. It's a treacherous place. But we're talking about hundreds of cases and no wreckage found. That's an important thing to state. I mean, that's the kicker to this kind of thing. You know, also, the water there is relatively clear and shallow, correct? So it is so strange to have hundreds of craft missing with no wreckage.
The most interesting cases are over the Bahama Banks, which can be a few feet deep to 50 feet deep. And in which wreckage in such shallow water will attract the growth of turtle grass. And so from the air, you look down on the banks, and they look like a nice, soft aquamarine because they're so shallow and it's a very sandy bottom. But where there's wreckage, where there's rocks, you will see this discoloration, the marled look of a little oasis 20 feet underwater. But of all the aircraft and ships that have disappeared, none of them have ever left, have ever left a mark where turtle grass or anything grows. And the locals are very familiar with the bottoms and the way it is. You know, when there's something like this happens, the divers will go out because they assume a wreck and they assume conch will be growing there, and it's been good for fishing. But with all those that have vanished, never has there been any sign that they crashed.
Wow. That's just, I've loved this mystery since I was a kid, you know, and you kind of alluded to the erroneous conclusions made by some other researchers. What are some of those? The biggest one I've heard about is the idea that the ocean releases some type of methane gas that affects vessels in the area. It sounds pretty far-fetched for an explanation. It sounds like the swamp gas type explanation. What do you think about that one?
Well, you know, some of the supposed rational explanations are just as absurd as some of the far-out ones. But the largest beds of methane are off the Carolinas, which technically are in the triangle by one shape or another. But if the gas, well, the methane would have to go through thousands of feet of sediment, thousands of feet of ocean, and erupt right under a ship as it's passing over. So what are the mathematic probabilities?
Right.
And it might happen with one. It's perfectly possible. There was a rig that drilled into a methane bed by accident, and it sank, and there were helicopters circling overhead filming this for the news, and they were unaffected. So even if you can get at least one ship that would sink suddenly from methane, it's not going to affect all the aircraft, and some of the aircraft disappearances are far more interesting.
Right.
In the terms of unexplained.
Now, before we get into
No one hijacks an aircraft.
Right.
You know, piracy is always a possibility for small vessels, but how do you stop an aircraft midway in flight and pirate it?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I want to get into some of the cases, but before we do, the one other explanation I hear people say when they try to make the Bermuda Triangle seem less mysterious is that they say if you do the math on crashes and disappearances around the world, that the Bermuda Triangle really isn't that special of an area. But
that's incorrect.
Yeah, you could dispute that claim pretty easily, I would assume, right?
I did in my book in the first chapter, I think it was, that I compared all the Coast Guard districts. For example, the triangles in the 7th Coast Guard District. And the 1st Coast Guard District would be off New England. I compare the number of calls for assistance, which are very close, 9,500 opposed to 10,200 from New England to compared to the 7th Coast Guard District. But over the time I studied it, the whole decade of the 1990s, four aircraft vanished in foul weather off New England, compared to 20 that vanished in the triangle in fair weather.
Hmm.
And so there's the difference just in Coast Guard districts. People still pull out the old line that Lloyd's did a study in 1975. Well, Lloyd's doesn't even insure the smaller stuff, so their statistics wouldn't matter. And all the Coast Guard statistics show that the calls for assistance and the travel and traffic are very similar off all the East Coast. And yet the triangle stands out 20 times for disappearances.
Yeah.
And we're not talking about wrecks. We're not talking about a boatnik who's torched his boat with his barbecue, which has happened. We're not talking about, you know, someone who rams another one or whatever. We're talking about total disappearance, not wrecks.
Yeah, that's the most mysterious part of all. And as far as the cases are concerned, probably the most famous that I know about is Flight 19. And I know you've written a book specifically about the case called They Flew Into Oblivion. Can you tell us about that case and the conclusions you've come to?
Ironically, I don't believe it disappeared in the triangle.
Right.
I really can't say all that caused them to be confused over the Bahamas. Well, the flight leader's compass certainly malfunctioned. He said so. Why all of the pilots didn't say something, there were five pilots, why they didn't say we're on course and it's only your compasses, why they didn't mark where the sun was, why they did what they did, I can't explain everything, but ultimately I do not believe that the flight disappeared in the triangle, but in fact disappeared over southern Georgia.
Yeah, in the swamplands.
Yeah, in a federal refuge that's huge. It's 660 square miles, I believe. That's been proven to be very popular because I was objective enough to remove it from the triangles. I mean, it technically will always be the cornerstone of the triangle. That's what directed everybody's attention out there. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I do believe, although it got lost there, that it did disappear for a number of reasons, including search and rescue follow-up, and just some very hard things to explain about what happened that night in 1945.
And the reason I think the case is so popular is because five planes went missing. But, I mean, I guess you come to this conclusion because there were some radar reports in the Georgia area of five planes that were unaccounted for?
Air Transport Command, both at Brunswick and Jacksonville, reported five unidentified aircraft had a particular heading. And then they asked search and rescue, how can this be them? Search and rescue is telling them that they should have been down and out of gas by 8 p.m., but these radar reports are coming in at 8:50. Well, going over all that the Navy compiled, in fact, those aircraft had at least an extra hour of fuel on board. There were so many snafus coming out of Fort Lauderdale that there was a lot of acrimony between officers over this. And when I first began my research, some of them were still alive, and I just did not want to get in between some of it because they could get very adamant. Two of them refused to even be in the same room with each other.
Hmm.
And one had used dereliction of duty against another one, which is a very serious thing to say to a military man. So it's quite a controversy why there was such an erroneous gas estimate, why Fort Lauderdale didn't even know the actual time these planes were supposed to land. They were off by an hour.
Interesting.
So search and rescue was delayed.
Yeah.
And there were just so many snafus that when those radar reports came in, they were just kind of dismissed because they thought they should have ditched by that time. And when the Board of Inquiry actually challenged their search and rescue officer about those radar reports, said, "How did you evaluate those as negative?"
Yeah.
And he replied, "They never landed."
Interesting.
And that was his only excuse why those could not have been accurate reports, because they logically should have landed at Daytona or Jacksonville or something.
Right.
No other thought entered his mind. And certainly higher up saw the problems. I mean, there was the overall Admiral F.D. Wagner said there was obviously a lot of problems in the search and rescue.
Huh. Now, another interesting thread to the Bermuda Triangle is that a lot of UFO investigators have claimed that it's a UFO hotspot. And I know there's a couple of cases, I don't know how credible they are, where people talk about being involved with seeing some type of strange UFO or flying craft. Have you investigated any of those cases that seem credible?
So there's only that one, technically, in 1980. I have the May Day on my website, so people can listen to it. The pilot is panicking. He's calling San Juan Airport, and he is talking about a weird object interfering with his craft. He's off the coast of San Juan near Cabo Rojo, is it? It's where there was an awful lot of Ajuntas. Remember the Ajuntas flat back in the 70s?
Mm-hmm.
This was the area off Puerto Rico where that began. And so in 1980, this guy's flying a plane with his friend in the passenger seat. And 35 miles off the coast, he's panicking over the weird object. And he keeps avoiding it, and he's trying to avoid it. And the Iberia flight is relaying San Juan's instructions and trying to explain, ascertain what is the problem. And the aircraft is actually on Atlantic Weapons radar at the time. And around 8:03 p.m., it simply vanished.
Wow.
There was no more communication. An object reappeared on the radar scope, ostensibly supposed to be the plane, but it was tracking in a different direction. It didn't answer any calls, didn't send any calls, and then it vanished too.
Wow.
And so there simply was no evidence of what happened. And the plane was owned by an Aero police officer of Puerto Rico. His son was the passenger, and his son's friend was the pilot. So the father spent hours and hours in his own helicopter trying to find out what happened. And in the end, according to the sister, they had no answer except, the only connection was the weird object.
Now, did he describe the object at all? Were there any characteristics that were delivered?
No, just weird object. No, just you can listen to the May Day on my website. It'll take several listens to understand both his accent and try and get it clearly, but he just calls it a weird object.
Ah.
In the report, in the whole National Transportation Safety Board report, the father an owner of the aircraft, does state about his own research. And he called it, the report's in Spanish, so he called it an objeto luminoso. So he called it a glowing object in the report. Where he got that, I don't know, because it's only called a weird object by the pilot, who was Jose Maldonado Torres.
Interesting. So now when it comes to these cases of people who've lived to tell the tales of the triangle, what are some of the major themes of strangeness they've encountered?
It is what is the most interesting thing that people, I think, should accept is true, but they don't have to put any kind of paranormal explanation on it. But this is the crux of the whole enigma of the triangle, and that's the electronic fog.
Right.
And this is something that's real. Even Charles Lindbergh wrote about it finally in 1976 in his autobiography of Values. He wrote about his flight from Havana and in the Spirit of St. Louis, and he believed he passed into a gray mist fog bank. His ground induction gear, all this early navigation gear and his compass went wacky. And he continued to fly along. He could look up and see the stars. And he tried to get above the fog, but he couldn't. And but he finally came out of this, and he was 300 miles off course. And amazingly, that is what so many others have said. Bruce Gernon is one of them. He coined the term electronic fog, and he encountered it twice. And he said, you know, it looks like a fog bank when you're in it, but that's not the case. It travels with you. You are not traveling through it. And you can look up and see the sky. You can look straight down and see the ocean. And it's rather like you're in a donut.
Weird.
It's all around you, but right immediately you can look down and see. So there it's kind of like a vortex. And that's basically what Lindbergh was describing without knowing it. He kept trying to get on top of this. And Bruce said that is the big mistake to make, that you are traveling through it. It is traveling with you.
Right. It's like maybe if it's electromagnetic, maybe it's attracted to the metal of the craft and just
Well, it should not be, because aircraft have leech lines. They're supposed to dispel the static electricity. Boats have zincs. They're supposed to discharge that. So this is something. It's electromagnetic, but it's not something you're familiar with, because it should not be able to hold onto an aircraft.
Right.
A sonic fog exists. If an aircraft goes at a certain speed, it can condense the atmosphere around it. And you've seen these famous photos Boeing takes of experimental jets, and there's this big powder puff cotton ball around the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's sonic fog. That's well known. But it just puffs away behind the aircraft. It doesn't hold onto it. The electronic fog does hold on to the aircraft or the boat.
Now,
and so it's not supernatural, but I would suggest, since the Bermuda Triangle is so intimately connected with electromagnetic aberrations, pilots and shipmasters speaking about twirling compasses and odd fogs and lights and strange things, that we're talking about an electromagnetic phenomenon out there that's rather unique to that area.
That's fascinating stuff. Now, there's another interesting case that I had heard, because the disappearance of craft is just what's so eyebrow-raising to me. But there's a famous case of a guy who was towing a barge through the triangle. Are you familiar with that case at all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Captain Don Henry.
Can you tell us about that one?
That's an incident of the electronic fog, probably. The good news, his tugboat was towing the barge from, I think, San Juan to Miami, and over the tongue of the ocean, this unusual fog. First of all, he was in the near the bridge, and the people on the bridge were panicking. The compass was twirling. He went up there trying to figure out what happened, and he looked behind. He said it's instinct whenever you're hauling anything. And so he looked behind, and he couldn't see his barge. It was surrounded in this fog that just hung around it. And it was, they could go back and pull on the rope that held the barge, and they couldn't see it. It was there, but they couldn't see it because just local puff, like this big cotton ball, was around the barge.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, when that disappeared, all the power came back on the boat. The batteries that he was carrying were drained, but the compass was now working again. And so that's quite a famous case, one of the best-known ones for the electronic fog occurring on surface level.
And was the barge still there when the fog cleared?
Yes. When it was still there, they went back and checked it, and he said the water, it was warmer than it should have been.
Wow. Now, I've heard of some of the more strange cases involving time slips, where a strange amount of time seems to go by, and that they can't explain that. Is there any credibility to those type of stories?
They appear implicitly in a couple of reports. One Civil Air Patrol student took off without permission from St. Thomas. He didn't give his destination, but 5-6 hours later, he's in a twin aircraft, a Beechcraft, so 5 or 6 hours later, they finally pick him up, and he's off Miami. This is a 1980-81 incident. He says that he's lost in fog at 150 feet altitude. He says it's clouds at 150 feet, and he's going to have to ditch because he's out of gas. Miami didn't understand because the weather was perfect off Miami. But Miami also didn't hear him. This was relayed to Miami from two jumbos off of Bermuda that picked him up 1,000 miles away. So it was written off. They went out and looked. They couldn't find him. They thought this was a pilot who was not qualified. And he simply ditched and didn't survive, and there was no trace. Well, lo and behold, 11 hours later, Caicos Island Tower, which is an island about midway between San Juan, Puerto Rico, and Miami, so about 600 miles away from Miami in the Bahamas, gets a call from a young man's voice. They say they got the call number, the registration number of the plane quite accurately. He said he was 10, this was 11 hours later now. And they said he said he was 10 miles out, and could they clear him for coming in for landing. And they said, yes, they had no idea this aircraft was being looked for. And so they clear him, and he still doesn't come in. And there's no trace there. You cannot fly in and fly out of anywhere in the Bahamas and refuel without being clocked in. And so how was he still on the flight 11 hours later and 600 miles away after fuel starvation? So that's right. One of the confusing cases. There's other ones in which an SOS was picked up many hours after the aircraft had to be down. It's a bit of a mysterious case. Bruce Gernon has mentioned the time lapse when he encountered the electronic fog, that there was... He was 30 minutes ahead of schedule, and he should not have been, and he could not account for it. The fuel had not been consumed either, he checked. So that would be his 1970 incident. So you get some. They're very vague.
Yeah.
But there are allusions to it. There are allusions to the electronic fog and also to time.
And let me get weird on you for a minute. When I was a kid, I heard this story that really struck out to me. I believe it was on Coast to Coast. And I can't find any information on it. When I was trying to prepare for the show, I was looking for it. But as I remember it, there was a plane flying around looking for this particular airport below. And they have radio communication on the ground. And they're saying to this plane that they're seeing it with no problem. But the pilot is saying that he sees nothing down below but trees and overgrowth. And the speculation was that this pilot was looking through some type of portal and was seeing the Earth possibly at a different time. Maybe before the airport was built. Are you familiar with a case like that, or was I just listening to a crazy person?
No, that was June 1969. Carolyn Cosio with her boyfriend, Robert Rosen, they were flying over Grand Turk in the Cessna 172. The thing is, I have the brief to that accident, but the accident reports have been lost since that time, so I've never seen the details to try and explain all of that. But that, to what you've recounted, I think some of it's probably legendary,
right?
That the tourists were annoyed by the aircraft circling overhead, and then the aircraft took off into the sea. But Carolyn Cosio had been telling the radar, the radio control, that there's nothing down there. It may have been two different aircraft. I don't know if it was the electronic fog, and she simply couldn't see, and it didn't appear any, you know, didn't make any impression on those on the ground. I don't know how visible the electronic fog can be from whatever angle. So maybe that's it, but I would have to find the report until I get really detailed.
Right.
There is a case that I do have the report to in 2001, in which an aircraft was playing tag for training purposes with a Coast Guard interceptor for drug interception. This was off Marathon Key in the... in the Florida Keys. The ceiling and invisibility was 12 miles, and everything was fine. And the Coast Guard aircraft reports fine. Marathon reporting, weather reporting station confirms. But the pilot, I want to say his name was Chuck. I can't remember it. But he suddenly reports himself IMC, which is Instrument Meteorological Conditions, which means he's in meteorological conditions, and yet it was clear to everybody else. He apparently does the dead man spiral. He loses complete control of his horizon, and he disappears. And a search, a couple days later, finally finds a couple pieces of the aircraft so that he might have gotten spatially disoriented and crashed. And that's a very implicit allusion to the electronic fog, and that he was in perfectly clear conditions, and so was everybody else. But suddenly he alone is IMC, and those are basically his last words, and then he's gone.
Wow. Now, I guess in more modern times, you said this was from 2001, I would assume that in more modern times, there would be better technology for tracking these crafts or transponders or the black box. I mean, for the black box, of course, you've got to find the plane, but has...
This was a small little puddle jumper aircraft.
Oh, gotcha.
I don't think you'd have a black box. But, yeah, you'd have to find the aircraft. But, well, 120 aircraft, I've checked, have carried ELTs, which... is the emergency locator transmitter. This is the little electronic automatic alarm that when the aircraft impacts, it will jettison the auto alarm.
Mm-hmm.
And this electronic signal, will be picked up by base stations, by passing aircraft, and even by satellites. And it can float at sea, of course. That's what it's designed for. And the whole purpose of such an invention is to mark the point where there was an impact so rescuers could go there quickly. 120 craft, I know, by my last count, have carried these, and not one of them has ever left an automatic alarm signal indicating they impacted.
Interesting. So the mystery of the triangle still defies our modern technology even now. Man. Now, when you look at the radio communication between crafts that are in the air or vessels that are on the sea and their counterparts on land, is there any more information we can extrapolate to try to come to a conclusion based on what they say?
I would say not, because the disappearance, whatever is causing them, seems to be very sudden. And for those that disappear on radar, we know that because one sweep of the radar, they're there, the other sweep, they're gone. That applies even to a DC-3. And there was no wreckage when they went out and looked at the spot, and they knew exactly where it disappeared from the radar. Whatever happens is very sudden. And I don't think there's really, except in a very couple of cases, like Torres panicking off of Puerto Rico, there's really no chance for them to say anything. They're either trying to control the aircraft or understand what's happening, or the radio's not working, mm-hmm. or simply they are gone. One twin-engine charter Beechcraft left Miami or Fort Lauderdale, headed for Bimini, which is only about 56 miles away off the coast. It slowed to a dangerously low airspeed of like 90 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. Had six people on board. And then it went into a dive, and they're not answering any calls. They're not sending anything. Disappeared off radar. They went out there looking, and they, of course, didn't find a trace. But two witnesses quite a distance away off Bimini reported seeing an aircraft plunge into the ocean off Bimini. Well, they had the right spot because they thought, and so the Coast Guard went out there and looked. It's only 18 feet of water, and yet there's still nothing there. So I don't know if they were seeing a mirage of the actual aircraft plunging into the Gulf Stream or what.
Oh.
But even though it was not completely sudden, radar controllers were amazed at why this aircraft was suddenly 100 and some odd miles to 90 before it plunged. Still, there was no communication from anybody in the aircraft.
Creepy stuff. Now, let's talk about some of the more far-out explanations. I mean, one of my favorite when I was younger was the idea that Atlantis has been there and sunk into the sea, and that they had a lot of electromagnetic technology that was still active and affects crafts in the area. I think some of that came from Edgar Cayce, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it did. Charles Berlitz and J. Manson Valentine made that very popular. Well, you know, if you accept that the triangle is really the adventure area, you have to accept the triangle's two things. One, it's the enigma of the triangle, which is that more aircraft and ships vanish in fair weather without any known cause. Number two, that it is an actual geographic area, obviously, between Bermuda, southern Florida, Puerto Rico. So whatever is going on in there, whether it's high sails, high seas, hijinks, or piracies, or disappearance, or voodoo rituals, or strange ruins on the bottom, it is part of the Bermuda Triangle enigma.
Yeah.
So you can talk about Atlantis, and there are unusual man-made ruins, but there's no evidence that Edgar Cayce's Atlantis, the Twali Stone, I believe it's called, is pulsing off of natural energy in the rock, is the theory, and sending a ship or plane into another dimension or disintegrating it outright.
Yeah. As far as ruins are concerned, I mean, Bimini Road is located there, which is like some underground, undersea ancient mm-hmm. ruins they've found. Can you tell us about that at all?
Well, it's very well known. It's an inverted J. There's other segments running parallel to it. It's in, 20 feet of water at least, off Bimini. It's quite beautiful. I mapped the whole thing, but it was shrunk, I think, so much for my book, you really can't appreciate it. But on my website somewhere, you can actually click onto it and see all the stones and how it's arranged. It looks like Inca artwork, Inca stonework, polygonal stones, like Sacsayhuaman.
Mm-hmm.
But it's on its side, so it's either a platform or it was a wall that fell over. The general theory is it's an ancient dock or something. And that's why people, to some extent, do believe in Edgar Cayce's Atlantis, the super civilization out there, is that he had said that they're going to find something around Bimini one year. And so J. Manson Valentine was the one who dived and then found the Bimini stones. So people say, see, that's the fulfillment.
Yeah, it's a little off, but you could twist the pieces to make them fit. Another interesting aspect to the ruins there at Bimini, the Bimini area, is that they are located, or they're actually on the Perry Reese map, which is something we've talked about with a previous guest, which is an old ancient map. And it appears like there's something there, but it's not underwater on the map.
No, I actually discovered that. I had a big article on that long time ago, and then Graham Hancock picked up on that, too, and he had it in one of his books, Underworld, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that page is still up on my website. I have so many pages, you'd have to dig through there. But you will see it on the Piri Reis, which I have a blow-up section, and it is in a map on the Bahamas. What island they're trying to convey, but it is on land. If it's Bimini or not, or some other place, ancient cartographers did mark a significant, to mark an area, did use something significant that was unique to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously this cartographer was told about huge stones on an island.
Interesting.
So they knew about it.
Yeah, that's very cool. I love that kind of stuff. And another theory that gets tossed around, we kind of alluded to it earlier, this is mainly in paranormal and conspiracy circles, but they talk about that time warp phenomenon, or, a multidimensional portal there. Is there any kind of science that could support that type of theory?
There's, time is, if you're going to go by it strictly by Einstein's, that a heavy mass will bend space in there with time, according to his theory. That's based on, atomic clocks at orbital heights and at sea surface will record time slightly differently. It's very minor, but it's moving slower.
Mm-hmm.
We're recording it slower. It's not moving slower. It's at the closer to the center of gravity. Well, if you can bend space by another means other than a massive object, if you can bend space by electromagnetic wavelengths that are obviously within space, they're through us all, they're everywhere, could you bend time? Could you slow it? We know how to slow it just by bending space. So, excuse me, that would be the closest you can come, is that with the electromagnetic phenomenon over the triangle, obviously it would need the sea. It doesn't happen over land.
Mm-hmm.
So it would, if the effects are right, could something, some vortex, bend space? In Project Magnet, Dr. Wilbert Smith, or Wilbert's, I don't know if he ever earned his PhD, but anyway, he was head of Project Magnet in Canada in the 1950s. He found these areas much more common in the tropics. He called them areas of reduced binding. They were diameter, circular diameter. They could get 1,000 feet in diameter, and they came and went. And so these areas of reduced binding became well known within the literature in the 1950s and were discussed in relationship to the triangle since they're more common in the tropics. And he thought that if an aircraft at high speed hit one of these, it would disintegrate. He said they come and go. Well, later research indicates that these could be magnetic vortices that's been into existence temporarily due to vagaries in the Earth's rotation. So if you have an invisible magnetic vortex out there, if you have a solar storm or something, the vortex could attract all the charged particles. This would be an invisible matrix spinning out there you cannot see. What would happen if an aircraft or a ship did come into proximity of that? Remember, charged particles after a solar storm will detect the magnetic lines of force
mm-hmm.
in our Earth's magnetic field. When there are clouds there, you'll see they get charged, and the clouds will begin to spin around the magnetic field lines of force. They look like a corkscrew. I have a picture on my website about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so now if you're thinking about this, basically perpendicular to the Earth, this magnetic vortex, what will happen out there if it's charged after a solar storm? I can't tell you what, but, you know, yeah. It's not something I would like to encounter. Because, you know, you're talking about an invisible cyclone, but yeah. A magnetic, electromagnetic cyclone. And there are pilots and shipmasters who have, you know, at night at sea, you can't see a water spout. You can begin to hear it in an aircraft, you won't. So what happens if you fly into one of these where you're going to be disintegrated right away?
Wow.
But what happens if you fly into one of these vortices, these magnetic vortices? Or even within proximity to it. Is that what explains the electronic fog? Is that what explains all the reports of compass malfunction?
Could be.
Just being near one? It's
yeah.
quite common in the Bahamas, you know. I've talked to enough people out there, and they say the only reason why it doesn't get more attention is that all these old hands in the Bahamas are used to point-of-sight navigating. They know the islands, the peninsulas. And they seldom look at their compass. But when they do, sometimes it's pointing in the wrong direction, and they joke, look, the Bermuda Triangle.
Yeah, that's trippy. How weird would it be? How wild would it be to learn that some of these crafts were going through some type of time portal and were popping out in other ages, maybe, you know, thousands of years ago? Maybe the high-tech UFOs that people see are crafts that have gotten stuck in the triangle in the future that have popped out in our time. That's some crazy speculation, but that'd be pretty wild.
They like to theorize about it, wormholes and all sorts of things. I remember I had agreed with Ancient Aliens. Why the History Channel has that show, I don't know, but they'd asked me to explain what the theory is that the aliens are based on Earth. And I said, well, I can explain it, you know, how it's based in the triangle, how Yvonne Saunderson made that very popular, and J. Manson Valentine believed that, and Edgar Cayce and all these guys said, so I'll explain it. And sure enough, they made it sound like I was endorsing it.
Mm.
And I don't. Certainly, I've investigated UFOs. You cannot ignore them if you have such references in an accident report. I'm not shy about investigating anything. But the whole theories that evolve about UFOs being based in the triangle, well, I have one accident report where it's a weird object is alluded to. I do know of incidents where there are lines on the shallow banks, as though an anchor was drugged, but it's not an anchor. It's as if something at high speed underwater went over it for a long time, and they go over islands and then start on the other side again.
Oh, wow.
But that is as close as you come, aside from lights and reports that people make of these strange lights, or even what they think is a craft coming and going from the water. So it's all subjective, except for that one accident report.
Now, probably the most far-out thing I've heard about that area, and it's probably a hoax, but I got to ask you about it, is the story of Dr. Ray Brown, where he said in the 1970s he was scuba diving, and he went inside of a sunken glass-like pyramid, and he took some crystal out of it, and then 5 years later he started showing this crystal at different conferences. Sounds way out there. I mean, have you heard of this story?
No, actually, I thought he was the one. There was someone out there who saw Bigfoot of the Deep. I remember that one.
What's that story?
I got one channel lost looking for that, looking for Jenny Hanover. Gabriel Figueroa got all upset when he was telling the story about the Amazon and what lives there, and he was telling Orson Welles back in the 1940s that there was such a creature that lived in the Amazon that was kind of like an amphibious walking man. And William Aland was one of Orson Welles' Mercury Theater people. He played the reporter in Citizen Kane, if you're familiar with classic movies.
Yeah.
Well, William Aland turned to production in the 1950s, and he was so fascinated by Gabriel Figueroa, who was a well-known director of photography. And Gabriel Figueroa had gotten so adamant when Orson Welles challenged him that this could not be true. So William Aland decided to turn this into a movie, and he is the producer of Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Ah.
And so that is supposedly, it does come from Gabriel Figueroa insisting adamantly that such a creature was reported in the Amazon. And there's a few people I've heard tell, one got in a book somewhere, about seeing such a thing called Bigfoot of the Deep, where you have an amphibian that has more or less a turtle type of back, hind legs, and kind of, you know, Bigfoot face.
Strange.
And once in a while, they can come up onto land and leave footprints in the Bahamas or wherever.
That's fascinating, but I doubt that. I know.
But that's not a crystal. He's the one I thought that saw that. I didn't know about the crystal.
Oh.
This was a famous swimmer. I thought Ray Brown does not strike. There's another Dr. Brown, or Dr. I forget who it is, that saw the glowing column off Bimini. Is that the same one?
I don't know. What's that story? That sounds familiar to me. Saw a glowing column underwater?
It's in Dr. Zink's book, The Stones of Atlantis, 1957. I can't tell you much, except I've asked certain divers to go looking. And I've seen a picture from that area that looks like something that fell over, but there's no column that they know of. But in Zink's book, you can see the picture. Looks like it's glowing, and the diver who discovered it, William Bell, that was his name, so no, it's not Brown. William Bell was getting bloody noses from being around this metal column he could not explain. By implication, of course, it was part of Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
You'll encounter an awful lot of odd claims out there. There's people who do some really weird things with quartz crystals while they're cruising over the Bimini Stones, and very odd things happen. Odd voodoo things happen, too. Voodoo sacrifices, rituals.
From the people in the Bermuda area?
Oh, yeah, in the Bermuda Triangle. Yeah, there's a lot of voodoo there.
Wow.
Very odd things. Ritual on ships, murder.
Ah. Strangeness.
There is, and then you have very unusual incidents where people think, well, you know, it's so shallow and crystal clear, the water, I'm going to go out in a little 15-20 foot boat and just go fish, or they go out in their kayaks, and they don't understand that barracudas can use the shallow bottom to push off with, and they'll jump in the boat and they'll grab you and pull you in.
Oh my God.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about evolution.
There's a number of derelict kayaks or small outboards, and you can pretty much guess that barracudas or something got them. I know of a case in 2010 in which two people were in a double kayak, and the barracuda saw her. The girl was in the back, jumped at her, bit her in the chest, punctured a lung, then jumped back in the water, and she freaked out. Unfortunately, she was with a guy, and he could call medevac, and they could save her. Had she been on her own, the barracuda would have come back around and drug her under, and you have then a derelict kayak.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I was just thinking about, like, considering the water is so shallow there, I was thinking to myself, you know, there's a place I should take a vacation. Go check out the Bimini Road. Now I'm not so sure that's a good idea.
Well, it's deep enough there, you don't have to worry, I think, unless they really get some speed and jump up in the boat. But a Coast Guard Petty Officer Powell was his last name, I think. He was off Andros Island with his outboard in 7 feet of water, that crystal clear, beautiful water of the Andros Island, and he vanished. They went out there, and his boat was still anchored, his fishing line over the end, you know.
Yeah.
No sign of a disturbance, no sign that a heavy power boat had cut up the sand underneath, and they never found a trace of him.
Creepy. Now, there are also some researchers that talk about this idea that if you map out some of the ancient world's historic sites, like Stonehenge and the Great Pyramids, and some people also include the Bermuda Triangle in this, that you'll find these sites on some type of ley lines or nodes of electromagnetic energy that maybe in the ancient past we were more aware of, or we harnessed this type of natural energy, but we've lost touch with it. A lot of speculation in that area. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Nope. I really don't. You know, I've read about it, but it's not something I retain as much because people that write about it associate it with some very erroneous facts in the triangle about where the electromagnetic incidents really occur, mm-hmm. concentrated at any rate. But to me, the triangle is the flipper, the real life adventure,
mm-hmm.
adventure and mystery. In a very exotic location, it's not a paranormal pursuit for me.
Sure, and I mean
I don't pass judgment on people for believing it's paranormal, but it's simply not what I do.
Yeah, I mean, the real mystery, the facts are strange enough that you really don't have to add a whole lot of that other stuff to it. But another thing I was going to ask you about, as I've always heard, the Bermuda Triangle holds some type of religious significance to Muslims and Hindus. And their culture?
Yes, to some Muslims. Yes, I got in trouble with them.
Did you?
Because the 12th Imam, to some of them, is supposed to, according to their prophecy, is to rise on a throne from the Sapphire Sea, and they say that's Bermuda, and they say because I'm regarded as the world expert that. I'm obliged to tell them what to do, how to get there.
You're the savior.
Give them more information. I had very odd communication about it after all the big terrorist insurgency in 2001, in which a couple really got adamant with me that I was to help them get there because they couldn't get in the U.S. anymore.
Oh.
And one of them was a Saudi. The other one was a Pakistani merchant mariner. And one had me in his dreams that he was to contact a man whose name means shank of beef. Well, that's not me, but he was to contact another man whose name means God of beginnings. And that's what my name actually means in
wow.
Italian. And so they said, yeah, I was in their dreams. I had to do this. I had to help them, you know, get in the United States somehow.
That's far out. It is interesting, though, that cultures that are geographically not that close to the Bermuda Triangle would have legends of something coming from that area. And then in modern times, we find out that it is a strange anomalous area. That's kind of a strange correlation.
You can probably look on YouTube and find very serious dissertations from some within this Muslim section on the significance of the Bermuda Triangle. One of them was a doctor of something or other, and he wanted me to look at it to see if it was fine, and he was on Facebook with me and all that, and I said, that's nice of you to do that. I don't understand it all, but that he had a very serious dissertation on the significance of Bermuda in certain things in the Quran, and that the Bermuda Triangle may be a blueprint to this, ostensibly the last imam.
Very cool. So I understand how the electromagnetic fog could confuse pilots and cause them to crash, but man, the fact that we have no wreckage, that's so damn strange, man.
No turtle grass, no little islands. They're called the Eye. 55 miles east of Bimini, and where the Bahama Banks is just nothing but a sandy underwater desert, 20 feet down. Mm-hmm. You can come across this marled area from the sky, and they went down there to have a look at it, people I know, and of course it's an airplane wreckage. And that's why the turtle grass grows down there. I have pictures on the website, and I think Dr. Little was one who went down there, and Bimini Brown. And, you know, sure enough, whenever the old hands see one of these marled locations that they'll call the Eye or the whatever, they know there's wreckage there. That turtle grass has taken up to 10 years, and it will grow around this. And so they go and look. And then this aircraft can't be identified. Right now I've looked at the propeller. I've been on TV looking at the propeller and everything, but until when it came out of the warehouse and everything, but can't really find out who had this aircraft. But that is an example of an aircraft that is wrecked. Now, all these that vanished, granted, they don't leave wreckage immediately for the searchers to find, but within years, there should be these mysterious eyes, these marled areas appearing on the plush sands of the Bahama Banks, but they never have. One ship, not one aircraft that has disappeared has ever been found through divers, just curiously finding a new little oasis of turtle grass on the bottom of the otherwise previously just deserty, sandy bottom of the Bahamas.
Weird. So are there any prevailing theories that you put out to explain where the crafts have been disappearing, or are you just leaving it up to mystery?
Oh, I believe the electronic fog, that electromagnetic phenomenon, is quite intimate with the whole thing. With all that I documented, with all these different disappearances, I assure you it's multifactorial. Not all of these vanish for the same reason. Some, you know, are just pilot didn't know what he was doing. Piracy certainly can be involved. But even out of, 300 and some odd cases, if only 30 or 40 of these are truly mysterious from the electronic fog, that is, you have a phenomenon that has to be looked into much more closely. Mm-hmm. And it does exist. I mean, there's no question that does exist. There are some meteorologists who now accept it. David Paris is one. He's been trying to figure it out. He's worked with Bruce Gernon on it. And so I do believe that what we consider to be the ultimate enigma of the triangle, the electromagnetic phenomenon, the strange fog, the spinning compasses, it's quite associated that the electronic fog points to something much deeper underlying in the ocean and the atmosphere there, and that ultimately solving that will tell us what the enigma of the triangle really is, what underlies it all. People should have to understand it is still a great adventure. It's not something to be dismissed or to be erased by too much theorizing. Do stick with the basic information that more aircraft and ships do vanish, and be curious enough to look as to why. Don't just dismiss it. Mm-hmm. Or fantasize about it.
Great advice. Well, man, that does about do it. The world is a weird place. There's so much we still don't know, and I'm glad people like you are out there trying to get to the bottom of some of this weirdness. Would you like to tell the people about any of your other work or give them your website before I let you go?
They can go to www.bermuda-triangle.org to see all that I do. I will be spinning all this other stuff off into a separate website because I look for all sorts of things. I was called the real-life Kolchak because I investigate so much different stuff. So you can check out my research in finding the real Mount Sinai or into true crime, Jack the Ripper, the EAR, Zodiac Killer, Bigfoot, everything. But all that will soon be moved to a whole other website so that the Triangle site, which is huge, just remains on its own with Flight 19, the Triangle, and the Cyclops disappearance.
Very cool. Awesome, man. Well, it has been great talking to you. Thanks so much for being here, and take care of yourself. Hopefully, we'll get to the bottom of things eventually.
Thank you very much.
There we have it. Gian Quasar, cool guy extraordinaire. Thanks for listening, people. Another Money Bomb starts today, and hopefully this one won't be a disappointment because I know the amazing things I have been working on for the 100th episode special won't be. I can't thank everyone enough and the people at Vapor Genie for taking care of me. One more time, I want to mention that if you are a Redditor, people at the subreddit Higherside Chats, I'm trying to make it pop. I love Reddit. Anyway, see you next week. Your move, Aquatic Bigfoot.
I guess you've heard about the Bermuda Triangle. There's something going on. Nobody seems to know just what it is, and the Air Force won't let on. Might be a hole down in the ocean. Yeah, or fog that won't let go. Might be some crazy people talking, or somebody that we ought to know. Down in Bermuda, pale blue sea, way down in the triangle, it's easy to believe. Now here's one, you see strange shapes in the light, shadows in the night. They said that wingtips seemed to brush their faces, and strangers stole their sight. Way down in the triangle, where the sea was smooth as glass, giving you an answer to a question that you never thought you'd ask. Ah, down in Bermuda, in the pale blue sea, way down in Bermuda, yeah. Down in the triangle, easy to believe.
Galveston, they leave from New Orleans, and then from Bloomington in Delaware. They leave St. Petersburg, they leave from Tampa, and then from Mexico, it doesn't matter where. They grip what they share. Safe in your harbor, everything seems certain. Right next to Palm Beach, you keep it skein behind a velvet curtain. But then the moon goes gray with worry, and the sea turns a pale white. You better believe something strange is going on tonight. Bermuda Triangle.